Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Acclaimed playwright and screenwriter Kenneth Lonergan has worked on such a wide range of projects that it can be challenging to sum up his work in one paragraph. From classics like This Is Our Youth and Analyze This to blockbuster hits like Gangs of New York and Manchester by the Sea, for which he won an Oscar in 2017. Lonergan's work is unified by his complex characters. Now one of Lonergan's earlier stage productions, The Waverly Gallery, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2001, is making its Broadway premiere. The play opened on October 25th and focuses on a family grappling with the matriarch's battle with Alzheimer's disease. Very pleased to welcome Kenneth Lonergan to the studio. Hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
So it's interesting, that's the plot.
Yeah.
It's very direct, it's very simple. It's a family dealing with this incredibly difficult time.
Yeah.
Is this in fact autobiographical?
Yeah, it's quite autobiographical.
Who was in your family?
It was my grandmother, my mother's mother. It's all pretty much the way it is in the play. It's a play, not a autobiography, but it's very closely based on all my family and the events around my grandmother's last 2 years when she was able to function and live in her apartment and go to her gallery.
Yeah, there's a great line, which is a big laugh line in the play, is that we're liberal Upper West Side atheistic Jewish intellectuals. Is that a close description to your family?
It's an exact description.
What is it like to write a play that hews so closely to your personal life?
Well, I've never done it before or since. I've obviously used material from my life and transformed and combined with other material before, but this is the closest I've ever come to my, you know, actual people in my life, unadorned and untransformed. So I don't know, it's sort of weird. It's a strange play for me because it's both a memory and a play, and what's a bit weird about it is that it's is not so much that the play is a memory, but that the memories have become a play. So in a way, so they're these family events, but I now am used to them both in memory form and in play form. So that can be a bit strange. In a way, it was easy to write because all the material was already there. And in another way, it was difficult to write because it's hard to figure out what material to use and what material to leave out.
Did you have any input from family members later who said, Kenneth, I don't remember it that way? Or Kenneth, right on?
Or? Yeah, they all pretty much, well, I have a lot of brothers and sisters, and one of them saw the play and said, well, I guess you can just write down everyone's conversations and make it into a play. Pretty much everyone recognized the family and the events, and it's pretty accurate. You know, you have to theatricalize it so that it becomes a play and isn't just a living notebook or anything like that. But nobody told me I'd gotten anything wrong. I mean, possibly I did, but nobody pointed it out to me.
How many siblings do you have?
A lot. I've a big extended family of three step siblings, one half sibling, one whole sibling, and an adopted sibling.
Wow, so that is a big family.
Yeah.
The narrator, the person whose memory this is the grandson. Is that because this is your story? Why not make it the mom?
It is the mom's story. It's through the eyes of the grandson and through his and it's the play is structured around his direct address to the audience. I don't know why. You know, you have material you want to work on, and then the form that it takes is the way it enables you to make it into a story. And you don't always know why one structure or another comes out, but it usually feels like the only structure possible after you're done. It's kind of a funny thing that happens when you're trying to write something.
The main character, Gladys, is this vivacious woman. She's clearly had this sort of extraordinary bon vivant kind of life. What choices did you make as a writer so that we knew that? Because we don't see her at that point in her life.
Yeah, I mean, people tend to show you who they are through their conversation if you're not around for their actual activities, and that wasn't such a challenge. I mean, She talks about herself. The others talk about her. There's a scene in which the rest of them there's a character who isn't in the family, a painter who she adopts more or less temporarily. And there's a scene where the family is describing her, Gladys, as she used to be to the painter. And, you get a little bit of the family history there. And that was a later addition. I mean, the play was written fairly straightforwardly. It wasn't a ton of rewriting, but that, I remember, came in a bit late, and I was always happy to have that scene because I think that's the scene where you most clearly get a picture of what she was like before. You certainly get it through her personality, and that's one of the amazing things about mental decline is that the personality doesn't really go away. It's fragmented and broken up, and the information that you can retain and understand is slowly demolished, but the personal traits really don't go away. If you're stubborn, you stay stubborn. If you're cheerful, you stay cheerful, depending. Even if your mood varies, the way you do things and the way you express yourself and the way your mind functions that's personal to you somehow survives the most fearsome damage, which is both upsetting because the person doesn't go away. They're still there. Mm-hmm. They're still there suffering through what they're going through. They don't just go to another place. And also kind of impressive to see just how dogged personalities are.
I thought the costume design was fantastic in that way because there was a woman of a certain age at a certain time that was, no matter her age, she would be perfectly turned out.
Yeah. Well, that's our brilliant legendary costume designer Anne Roth, who is just a genius, and part of her genius is working with the actors and with me and with everybody and the director, of course, to land on the costumes that feel right for everybody. She's amazing. She's just great to work with because she thinks about the characters so vividly and specifically. And the first thing you get from her is not what would they wear, but do they have a cocktail when they come home?
And, oh, that's interesting.
And you're like, what? And then you're like, oh, that's a real question about who they are and whether they come home and fix themselves a drink or don't. That's a certain kind of person, a certain kind of family, a certain kind of routine, and that tells you kind of a little bit about what they might wear.
And as she declines, she, especially in the second act, you see her looking like a little old lady, where in the first act she looks like a woman of a certain age, as we say, right?
Yeah, well, that's, again, that's really expressive of what's happening in the story and what would be happening in real life. She's not dressing herself as much. She's less aware of how she looks. Things get a little more fundamental. She starts to wear flats and sneakers where she would have worn heels because she's less involved in social life. Mm-hmm. And that happens with a lot of older people or people who are ill.
We're speaking with Kenneth Lonergan about his play, The Waverly Gallery, which is currently playing on Broadway. And Elaine May is in the lead role, and it's her first time in Broadway in more than 50 years, I believe. What was the process like to get Elaine May to say, yes, I will be in The Waverly Gallery?
Well, Elaine May, I actually am friends with, which is still, I can't believe. My wife was in a play of hers several years ago, and we got to know her and became friendly with her and with Jeannie Berlin, who's also a good friend, who was in a film that I did. And so I had often thought of Elaine for this play, for a revival of this play, and I asked her, but I asked her about 5 or 6 years ago, and at the time she was busy or she wasn't interested or said other things to do, and then we asked her again this last year, and she said yes. It was very exciting because she's my dream casting for this part and has been for many years. You know, the first time it was done by Eileen Heckert, who is also a magnificent actress and was incredible. They're very different, so it's a very different interpretation and a different embodiment of the character. But she's just a genius, and I just love her. So it's an incredible good fortune to have her in the show.
As you're writing the script, there are lines that are very funny for the first third of the play.
I hope so.
And then they get a little cringy in the middle, and then they're kind of sad at the end because we're witnessing this sharp woman's decline. How did you decide about that rhythm, about how a line about the dog, she's obsessed with the dog at one point, or about, there were several that would just keep repeating.
Yeah. Well, I don't know exactly. Most of it's not really a conscious decision. You just you're trying to get to the place where you see the scene and you hear what they're saying and you understand what's going on in the room, and then in as much as it's possible, you know, it's a cliched phrase, but you try to let it write itself, and that doesn't really mean anything except that there's something happening in your mind where the dialogue is coming to you and you're channeling what's happening somewhat with your conscious mind more than probably I like to think, but when it's going well, you're not really thinking about every line, every sentence. You're not consciously manipulating the material. You know,
even when you're writing about when she's somewhat incoherent?
No, I mean, I just remember it really well, and I just try to put down what happened, and I try to recreate what I remember from how she spoke and the progression of how her mind fell apart. And, you know, obviously this is 2 hours on a stage, not 2 years in apartments, so there's a lot, you know, condensing and selecting a lot. But no, I mean, the thing I think about, I mean, I don't know what other people do most consciously, is what the structure is going to be. The rest of it, and it's sort of what allows, you know, you sort of have the feeling, that famous thing of Michelangelo where the statue is inside the marble, and and what it feels like you're doing is paring away the excess. And that's a bit what it feels like when you're constructing a plot. You get the feeling for the storyline, which in this case is very simple, and then that allows the scenes to emerge from some hidden place. And so you're sort of balancing back and forth this feeling of allowing your unconscious to write the play with sort of guided and governed by your conscious ideas about the shape you want it to take and where you think it's going to go. And so smaller details like where the jokes come happen pretty spontaneously as you're writing it. And then you say, aha, that's funny and that's working, and you leave it in. Or you say, aha, that's not so great, and you take it out.
You mentioned earlier this isn't the first time the production has been staged, and it's
1989 to 90, 91.
Yep. Greenwich Village, Waverly Place, obviously, and the Upper West Side where her children live, Gladys's children live. Now that it's 2018, were you ever interested in updating it?
No.
In addition to being of a different time?
No, I don't like to do that. I mean, it is what it is. It was written when it was written. I think that it was written as best it could be written, and I don't think I know the same things about it now. You know, I'm 20 years older. I was very much in it at the time, and I don't think I would have the same insight or relationship to the material. I could write maybe a different play about that time, but I would have different thoughts and feelings and ideas about it.
We're speaking with Kenneth Lonergan about his play, The Waverly Gallery. There's two other casting choices which are interesting in the sense that Michael Cera was in Lobby Hero.
Yes.
The play you had on Broadway earlier this year, and he has sort of nailed this misfit, kind of endearing but odd character that turns up in both of these plays. What is it about, A, that kind of character that you like to write, and then what is it about Michael Cera?
He was also in This Is Our Youth on Broadway 3-4 years ago.
Oh, I didn't see
as
it.
Well. Yeah, he was great in that too. He's just a great actor. I don't know. He's wanted to be in the plays, and I've wanted him in them. I often work with the same people more than once, and he's just great. I don't quite know what it is. He's a wonderful actor. He's got a great sense of humor. He's a great guy. He's really a deep actor, I think. He's got some kind of fluency that most people don't have, without it being just casual, like he doesn't just play himself. He can really play characters, but I don't know how he does it, but he's got this really great quality that he brings to his work. It just worked out that way, but I'd love to work with him again.
He's very good with the space in between the sentences.
Yes.
He knows how to use the pause.
Yeah.
And let each line do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
I think that was my observation.
Yeah, that's really true. And he's very present always, which is great. He's not, and you cannot see the wheels spinning behind his acting. You don't see him setting himself and saying the line one way. He's just very, and he's unselfconscious, and he works very steadily and thoroughly. And I don't know, he gets better and better every time you see him.
The other young actor who's in the play, with whom you've worked on Manchester by the Sea, is Lucas Hedges, and he's playing you, yes?
Some version of me.
A version of you. Did you have conversations about that with him?
I don't think we talked about my personality at all, which he can have his own opinion about. But I discussed what it was like to be in those rooms and to be watching those things happen and to be participating in them quite a bit. Just not because I wanted him to pin him down to that, but just because I thought it would be helpful as a place to start from.
As anyone who's had a parent or known someone in decline there, and this is something you capture in the play, is that anger. And you don't know if you're angry at the person or you're angry at the situation or you're angry at the disease. When you were writing it, how did you decide to use anger?
Well, the play is an attempt to be as truthful as possible about this really difficult situation that many, many people find themselves in one way or another. It doesn't always have to be a mental decline. It can be a physical decline. It's an older person or even a younger person who needs a lot of care and more care than most people can provide very easily. And people are very, and it's all people very close to each other. And the relationship does not just become one of, one where one person's being taken care of and the other person's taking care of them. The whole relationship is still there the whole time. And in a funny way, if you have a contentious relationship with somebody and they get sick, you don't want to drop that and just be nice to them, because that's not how you really relate to them. That's suddenly making them less than who they are to you. And, towards the end of the play, the relationship between the mother and daughter in the play is quite snappy from the daughter's point of view. They're very close, but it's not in daily life a particularly warm relationship. It's a very devoted one. They see each other once a week. There's a lot of mutual, the Gladys character is very enthusiastic and interested in her daughter, the Ellen character played by Joan Allen. But your mother can be a little intense to be around, especially if you're an adult. And to drop that and suddenly become her nurse feels not so much like it is a beautiful thing to do, but it also feels like a diminishment of the person you're taking care of. And you, suddenly they're an invalid who you're nice to all the time. Feels like you don't have a relationship with them anymore. So I think a lot of the anger is something you hang on to, apart from the fact that you can't help yourself. People get very annoyed with each other, especially under duress.
But often I think people feel incredibly guilty for getting mad at the person.
Oh, yeah. Like you,
that guilt is like hanging over the apartment. It's hanging over the relationship.
Oh, for sure. Because you just can't be, you can see the person can't help what they're going through. They still drive you crazy and you're under terrible duress and you snap and you lose your temper and you do all kinds of things you wish you hadn't done. And you feel really bad about it.
We're speaking with Kenneth Lonergan about his play, The Waverly Gallery. There's also, it's interesting that I had to go back and look at the playbill about 1989, because there also is a subtext about gentrification in the play. And you're a lifelong New Yorker.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on gentrification?
Well, as a lifelong member of the middle class and the upper middle class, I always like when the streets get cleaner and the neighborhood gets calmer. On the other hand, that tends to come with a homogenization, which nobody really likes. And, people who have been around for a long time driven out of the neighborhood, and the neighborhood all becomes one kind of person. So I don't know if I have any special feelings about it that everybody else doesn't have. You hate to see the city lose its character. You hate to see, block after block of what used to be a neighborhood with some personality turn into a bunch of chain stores and restaurants and cafes for upper middle class white people like myself. It's a mixed bag. You feel like the real city is being driven out to the periphery, and then the prices skyrocket. And so it's not just ethnic gentrification, it's economic gentrification. And suddenly you're living on Madison Avenue where you used to live on Bleecker Street.
That's what's so interesting about the play. It's this Waverly Gallery is going to be pushed out by a hotel.
The hotel that the gallery is part of in the play and in life was around for many, many years under different management. And then as the village kind of came out of the swill, chaos, and dirt and of the 70s that the whole city was kind of buried under because the economy got so bad, then they start zhuzhing it up and cleaning it up and rebuilding it so they can get a wealthier clientele. And then the older people, and you know, this happened not just to my grandmother, but if you go down Bleecker Street now,
oh yeah,
20 years ago, it was all local businesses. Mm-hmm. People had been around for a very long time, older people, some younger people, and now it's not only turned into Ralph Lauren and all these fancy stores, but half of them are now boarded up because nobody can pay those rents, not even Ralph Lauren. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really work for neighborhoods to do this to them most of the time. You kill the local presence, and then suddenly you can't sustain the bigger corporate presence, and you end up with nothing.
There have been 3 Kenneth Lonergan plays on Broadway in the past 4 years?
Yeah.
Will there be a fourth soon?
I certainly hope so. It's nice to be there.
You're not going to let me know what that might be?
I don't know. I have 3 other plays that I'd love to revive, and I have other plays I'd like to write, so I don't know which one will be there first.
Will we get a movie in there soon?
I'd like to do that, too.
You're not going to tell me what it'll be?
No, I don't know.
Oh, you don't know yet? No. Okay. Well, you need to get home.
I'd tell you if I knew.
Get home and get writing.
Yes, I do.
Kenneth Lonergan, the name of the play is The Wavering Gallery. It's now playing on Broadway. Thank you so much for taking some time to come visit us here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and we're going to check in with our colleagues from the land of podcasts. The team behind the Trump Inc. podcast, which is a collaboration between WNYC and ProPublica, has looked at how the president's administration and his business ventures relate to one another. Along the way, those folks have uncovered money laundering in the Trump casino, the ethically questionable legal practice of a longtime Trump fixer, Michael Cohen, and the Trump International Golf Club's purchase of potentially illegal golf balls bearing the presidential seal. This season, Trump Inc. has been shining its investigative light on the people President Trump surrounds himself with and how they make money. The season 2 finale of Trump Inc. comes out next week and will spotlight none other than Trump attorney and former New York mayor, Rudy Giuliani. As you can hear, there is no shortage of things to talk about with Trump Inc. host of NYC's Andrea Bernstein. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, so great to be here on All of It.
And one of the podcast editors, Eric Umansky of ProPublica. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You got your coffee, so you're good to go. Let's start, Andrea. I want to do some news of the day yesterday, because yesterday was, as every day is.
Yes, as every day, full of Trump Inky kind of news.
So you were down at court because New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood is making a case against the Trump Foundation, saying it's a shell corporation. What happened yesterday?
Well, so basically what the New York Attorney General has done is brought the civil action and said that there were no walls between the Trump organization, the Trump campaign, and the Trump Foundation. And the New York Attorney General regulates charities. And the argument is, okay, well, there are reasons why charities are walled off in this way. So one of the big focuses of this case is this fundraiser that Trump had. Do you remember at the beginning of the campaign, he didn't go to a debate. He said, I'm not going to go to the debate. Instead, I'm going to have a fundraiser for veterans. And so one of the big arguments is that that wasn't a Trump Foundation event. That was a campaign event. And then they raised money. It went to the Trump Foundation. But campaign officials, like former campaign chairman, campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, decided how the money should go, how it should be spent, and that it was spent on things that would help Trump's campaign. So that's the essential argument. You're not allowed to do that with a charity. You're not allowed to use a charity to fund or help or assist a campaign. And in addition to that, the Trump Foundation has been around since the 90s. Its board includes now Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric Trump. And the board has never met. There has never been a vote on how money should be spent. So there is the civil action. Yesterday, there was a court hearing about whether the case should be dismissed. No ruling yet. The judge did seem skeptical of some of the Trump organization's arguments.
What were those arguments?
So what they were saying is, well, look, money actually went to veterans. So does it really matter what the process was? Which is having now spent all of this time looking at Trump business and how they break so many rules and norms and in some cases, apparently even laws, they do seem to come back and sort of say, well, you know, does that really matter? And here is a case where this is actually before a judge and will be decided. So it's very exciting because it's one of the most live legal cases that shows this intermingling of Trump Foundation, Trump Organization, Trump Campaign that we at Trump Inc. are spending so much time examining.
It's interesting. You said three things: laws, norms, and what was the third? Laws, norms, and rules?
Laws, norms, and rules.
Laws, norms, and rules.
Yeah.
Eric, what's the difference between the three in terms of in Trump's mind? None? And when you think about Trump Inc. and this whole season?
Well, I definitely cannot speak to what's inside his mind.
I phrased that poorly.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But I can...
Only Maggie Haberman can do that.
Right, exactly. But I can lay out... You know, that is a kind of rubric that we've been thinking a lot about. We just have had an episode this week about taxes in which we break it down in that way. And so, you know, well, breaking the law is an actual law and you're breaking it. That is what the New York Times concluded the Trump family, Fred Trump, the president's father, did with regard to taxes and transferring wealth to his kids. Breaking norms would be, you know, and I think people are pretty familiar with this concept now, breaking what amount to unwritten rules. That would be with Trump not giving his tax returns. Right. Not publishing his tax returns, which is there's nothing illegal about it. There's no formal rule he is breaking. What he is doing is breaking precedent.
Big one, even that I think everybody knows about, is they didn't divest from his businesses. So this completely breaks all the modern norms and has given us in journalism an incredible amount of work trying to chase it all down.
I do want to go back to what happened yesterday. So the president's team is trying to claim there's bias here.
Right. And it was interesting because the judge was like not having it. She was saying like, you can go ahead and you can say that, but I just don't want to have anything to do with that. I want to talk about the legal matters. I mean, in this particular place in the lawsuit, there's a motion to dismiss on the table. And the motion to dismiss, the way it works is the judge has to say, okay, I need to accept that everything the attorney general has put forward is actual fact. So I have to accept as a fact that Trump's campaign manager directed the way these payments from the Trump Foundation should be made. I have to accept as a fact there was never a meeting of the board. There was never a vote of the board about how to spend money. I have to accept the fact that the foundation spent $10,000 on a Trump portrait and used Trump Foundation money to settle certain lawsuits that involved nonprofits. I have to accept all of that as true before I decide whether there's a motion to dismiss. Now, later down the line, they can argue the fact, but we're not at that point in the legal case. We're at the point of sort of, is this case going to proceed? And is the judge going to find the Trump Organization? And what the attorney general has asked for is a 10-year ban by Donald Trump and his three adult children, or the three that are on the board. Tiffany is not on the board, about whether they should get to serve on foundation boards for 10 years. So those are sort of the issues at play in this lawsuit.
I'm going to be very petty for a minute and talk about the portrait.
The portrait.
That's just straight up petty. That's where news meets petty. What was significant about the information that came out about the portrait?
So what came out about the portrait yesterday was what Trump's lawyer stood up and said as well. It was at a charity auction, and they started the bidding at $10,000, the foundation, and nobody bid on the portrait. So therefore, the Trump Foundation had to buy this for $10,000. That was what was said in court yesterday. It's a portrait of Donald Trump, to be clear, that is hanging in one of his properties.
We're speaking with Andrew Bernstein, host of Trump Inc., and Eric Umansky, one of the editors. He's joining us from ProPublica. We're discussing the season of Trump Inc., the season finale. They're working on it as we speak. If you have any questions for Eric and Andrea, this is your opportunity. The number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. And Michael Cohen made news, too, yesterday. Yesterday, a lot of stuff happened.
I didn't even know Michael Cohen made news.
He's been very active on his Twitter feed. Is this what we're talking about? Or are we talking about the case? So there was news in the Michael Cohen case, which was very interesting to us because the U.S. attorney, which prosecuted him, and is prosecuting him because he hasn't been sentenced yet. So the U.S. attorney the New York Times put in a petition for the U.S. attorney to release some documents. And the U.S. attorney said, no, we can't do that because we have an active investigation going on. So we don't know what that is.
An active investigation, I believe, citing other people. Which is,
right. That if they released the documents, we would find out information that is not in the public record about people they may be looking into in the Cohen case. So this has been very interesting, and it's one of the questions that we have been asking ourselves at WNYC and ProPublica is, what is the legal fallout from the Cohen conviction, and is he giving information to prosecutors about his work at the Trump Organization that could be the basis of legal charges? We don't know. We don't know what they're looking into, but it is certainly suggestive that they're saying we can't talk about it because we have something active going on.
Right, and we don't know who it is either, just to be clear.
Little piece of information came out, not specifically about Trump Inc. and what you've been covering, but I'm curious your thoughts on it and how it relates to the work you've been doing. The New York Times had a story yesterday detailing that the president's continued use of his personal iPhone, in spite of all these warnings for the lack of security, the Times is reporting the Chinese and the Russians have been listening in. And of course, the Chinese have been lobbying the president. How does this fit into the work you do? And how does this fit into Trump as you think about him and Trump Inc.?
Well, I think it fits in a couple of ways. One is, let's refer back to the norms issue. They haven't had cell phones forever among presidents, but the recent ones who've had them have typically not done this sort of thing. And they haven't because there are obviously security risks. There is also the issue, and we've actually dealt with this in a number of different stories, which is the typical protocols for who a president speaks to, for the process for deciding policies, has often not been in place here. So you have people who can just informally, or had people who could informally walk into the president's office and pitch something. And we also know that the president is often speaking to people who are, you know, informal advisors, don't have official roles. One can easily imagine one of the places he's doing that is on his unsecure iPhone that others are listening in on.
And we've done a couple of episodes this season of Trump Inc., which we're sort of broadening out beyond the Trump family to look at the people around Trump. So ProPublica did this terrific investigation of Sheldon Adelson, this casino magnate, and how he appears to be influencing the president, and how, in fact, President Trump put in a pitch with the Japanese prime minister for an Adelson casino in Japan. And this is all part of this sort of atmosphere where people can just walk right in, talk to the president, and as we know, he doesn't have much impulse control, so somebody will say something to him and he'll say it or tweet it out almost immediately. I mean, that's just a fact that we know from observation.
It's just right. What
and,
it is.
And, yeah. And you know, there's not a lot of records that you can go to FOIA that stuff or to dig into it because, you know, it's somebody just picking up the phone or somebody swinging
that's
by. And when that kind of thing has enormous influence, well, you know, I mean, that has lots of ramifications in terms of how our government is run and who it's run for.
We'll continue our conversation with Andrew Bernstein, host of Trump Inc., and Eric Umansky from ProPublica, one of the editors of the podcast. And we'll take more of your calls. We'll take some of your calls. The number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you have any calls for our guests, we'll meet you on the other side of the break. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and joining me in studio is Andrea Bernstein. I just made both your names wrong. Andrea Bernstein, thank you, host of WNYC's Trump Inc. podcast, and Eric Umansky from ProPublica, who is one of the editors of the podcast. So let's give a big overview of what you guys wanted to try to accomplish this season on the podcast, now that we're getting to the season finale.
Well, I can even back it up further, as editors so often like to do.
Sure.
Which is...
Get the context here.
Right, exactly. Let's just back up a step. And that is, you know, we started this project in January is when we really launched the podcast. It came from previous collaborative work we had done together. And, you know, we realized that there are so many fundamental unanswered questions about the president and his businesses and his business relationships. And we realized at some point, you know, as investigative journalists, you like to always give answers and to expose something. But one of the fundamental things here is the fact that there are so many unanswered questions is itself the story in right. significant part. And so we wanted to highlight that and to help people understand, particularly for a thing that sort of bubbles along in the background a lot, just how important these issues are and the magnitude of the unanswered questions. And this season, what we decided to do, and Andrea mentioned it earlier, is to not just look at the president and his businesses, but to look at the businesses around the presidency, and in particular, the people around the presidency with financial interests, and to look at how they're trying to influence the system, how they're working with the president. And as Andrea pointed out, one of those examples was Sheldon Adelson, basically the president's biggest funder. And next week we are looking at the president's lawyer who is frequently on television, the former mayor, Rudy Giuliani.
And there are some lesser known names. I mean, I think people who are interested in politics know Sheldon Adelson, and they obviously know Rudy Giuliani. Who are some of the lesser known people in his business orbit?
So the season opener this season was about a fundraiser named Elliot Broidy, who is somebody that people don't really know. And if they know, they forgot. So just to fix him in people's mind, he sort of had his 15 minutes of fame last spring when it turned out that he had made an agreement to pay a Playboy model who he had impregnated, and he had hired Michael Cohen as his attorney. So this came out after the Michael Cohen raid.
Paid her to keep quiet.
Right. It was a hush agreement. And also, he got in a dispute, or he started to work for Saudi Arabia, and he was in sort of trying to... he was trying to build a case against Qatar, and he felt that Qatar was a harbor of terrorism. So his emails were hacked. They were released to a lot of journalists. And as a result of this, we have this unusually detailed trail of how influence is being wielded in the Trump administration. And there's just all of these scenes that are described where he goes into the Oval Office. He witnesses a fight between Trump and his chief of staff. And in this context, he's going in and making a pitch for the way the administration's stance should be towards the Saudis and towards the Emiratis in the Middle East. So what you see is this real sort of breakdown of the structures around the president. And as we were saying, as a result of that, it is remarkable how much Trump will do, but also how much people are willing to pay for that. So we can sort of see it all laid out. I mean, I want to be clear that we have lived with corruption and influence peddling forever in American politics. But because of the breakdown of norms and rules and all the other things we're talking about around Trump, it is the opposite of draining the swamp is happening. It's just like the waters are flooding in and rising and rising.
Right. To use a little bit of a chutzpah, a Yiddishism, the chutzpah indicators are flashing red.
Well, this may sound obvious, but we've always known that Donald Trump is transactional. He's just blatantly transactional. So in some ways, should we be surprised by any of this? Or are you constantly surprised?
I
stumped the reporter.
I think one of the questions I will say, I mean, you know, one of the things that we've asked ourselves is, okay, so we've spent a year. The reality is we spent more than a year because we
really 2 years.
Okay, fine. 2 years. Right. This is investigative journalism. Every year is actually 2 years. And what have we learned? What do we understand now that we didn't have an appreciation for before? And frankly, I think, and there's no real gentle way to put this, but the more that we dig into the president's businesses, the more questionable things arise. And it's like, you know, it's sort of one of these funny things where every rock you turn over, there is something. You're not used to that as a journalist. And it is, quite frankly, a similar thing with the administration.
And we haven't even gotten to talk about the Pump and Trump story that we did, which was about this terrific reporting by Heather Vogel of ProPublica and Meg Kramer, the senior producer of Trump Inc., And what they found was there's this pattern of deception around the globe by Donald Trump and his adult children in selling their properties, and that it happened over and over and over again. And we spoke to a former high-level fraud prosecutor at the Department of Justice, and he said to us, well, when you see it happening over and over, that is a possible indication of a fraudulent scheme, of a corrupt scheme around the globe. And I think what surprises us is how pervasive it is,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That we keep running up against it. The New York Times story on Donald Trump and Fred Trump and his taxes was a sort of another permutation of that, that we keep seeing it. That actually surprises me. And I say that having covered corruption in politics for 25 years.
You know, when you listen to you talk and you describe, as you start to describe different things you hear every day, and then names start coming up, Saudi Arabia, obviously, we've all been thinking about Khashoggi all week. Do you ever feel like Carrie and Homeland? With a red line.
It has been invoked multiple times.
Have you seen my whiteboard? You should come and look at it after the show. I mean, it's exactly the way we feel. Like, it's like so-and-so is connected to so-and-so, and so-and-so is connected to so-and-so, and then they actually are. There are names that I throw up on my whiteboard that sort of show up in court papers a year later. So it's a sort of a constant theme is what to make of all of this. And our role, we feel, is to try to document it and make as much sense of it as possible.
I will also say one of the things that surprised me is, and it actually refers to the New York Times' story as well, that if you would have said to me, you know, 2 years ago or right after the election, that 2 years later, we are still going to be uncovering and understanding very basic dynamics and facts around the president's business, you know, historically and currently, that's an amazing thing that there is so much opacity and so many questions that there are still basic things we're trying to understand. What is his business? How does it make money? You know, and going all the way back to the 70s.
But what a perfect time in the media landscapes with podcasts being so healthy and so important and people having a hunger. You couldn't tell 10 years ago this would have been difficult to do. For you to spend this much time.
It is a... You know, it's kismet, to continue with the Yiddish. I also just wanted to say that we do get a lot of help from our listeners. We get tips. We have a tip line, tips@trumpincpodcast.org. If you go to our website, trumpincpodcast.org, there's a way to put in secured documents. And actually, right now, we are looking at, as a result of the Pump and Trump story about the Trump properties, we're asking people who have had experiences buying into Trump properties that failed and how that went for them. We're asking them to contact us at tips@trumpincpodcast.org. And we've already heard from some people, and we hope that they do.
Right. We've actually already heard some powerful stories. And, you know, we want to hear anybody's story who has bought a Trump property. You can go to trumpincpodcast.org. There's information there to contact us securely as well.
All right. I was going to ask you about season 3, but you have a lot to do. We'll have you back on the first. Eric Umansky from ProPublica and Andrew Bernstein. Trump Inc. is the podcast. Thanks to you guys for stopping by all of it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It never stops.
Friday, everybody. Do you have plans? We can help you out with that if you don't. Every Friday, we are happy to see WNYC's culture editor, Charlie Herman, because he brings us some great suggestions for events that have just opening and some that are about to close this weekend, so you might have your last chance to check it out. We call it Charlie for the Culture. Hi, Charlie.
Hello, Allison.
So what are you going to see this weekend?
So I think the one that really stood out to me is the Progressive Revolution Modern Art from a New India. It's an exhibit at the Asia Society, and it runs through January. And what you have here are several artists who may be known to many people, but I think a lot of people might come to the show and say, wow, I haven't seen these artists before. I'm not that familiar with them. And what it is in 1947, if you go back about 70 years ago, when India emerged after the British Empire left India and there was the partition that created Pakistan and India, you had these six young artists who all came together. They came from different parts of society. You know, one was a Roman Catholic and one was Hindi and one was Muslim. And what they were really doing was trying to create a new art, to create art that was no longer British. They rejected that style of painting and trying to come up with a vocabulary that could really encompass what this new India looked like, this new diverse, complex, a secular,
progressive
country. And what would that look like? And they wanted to be part of it.
And they were called the Progressive Artist Group.
The Progressive Artist Group. They, you know, if you, most of what is on view at the Asia Society are oil paintings. And I think many people may look at them if they're familiar with Western artists, American artists, and might say like, oh, well, that looks like a Picasso or that looks like a Rothko. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that while they may have been aware of, and many of them did travel to New York and London and Paris, the reality is that Western artists were borrowing from African artists and from Asian artists, and that they were also looking at things like Buddhism. So it's not that there is a pure one is borrowing from the other. There's a lot of borrowing that's going on. And in addition, you also have a lot of these Indian artists who were looking at folk art and their tradition and pulling stuff from there. So in the exhibit, dispersed throughout it, are some of the collection from the Asia Society of, you know, early terracotta horses that were painted by one of the painters. Or there are paintings from the 15th century about different Hindi gods. So, you know, there's a lot of traditions that they're trying to pull from in this exhibit. You know, I think the thing that it really stands out to me is that these were people who were really just trying to create a whole new vocabulary, and you group them all together and see what they were doing, and then it also tracks them as the years go on. And so even when the group dissolved, you see some of the people who came in later and some of their later works and really get a sense of them. You know, one of the things that's a bit sad, perhaps, is that the M.F. Hussein, who perhaps became the most famous artist of the group, an international artist, eventually had to leave India because he was Muslim. And as you began to see rising Hindu nationalists in the 1990s, and then in particular in the mid-2000s, they started to attack the work that he created, that they thought it was anti-Hindu. And so he eventually had to leave his own country and eventually became a citizen of Qatar and then died a few years ago in London. But again, this sort of sense of this, here are these people hoping that they could create an art that would unite all these different people. And we sort of have seen in the years later, it's also a bit of a sad story, too.
Was it political at all?
Or
was
I mean, their work was political in the sense of that they were trying to think, how do we create this new country? What's the idiom of visual arts that we can create that will speak for who we are as a country?
All right. That's what you should go see. That's just opening up the Progressive Revolution, Modern Art for a New India. Something that's going to leave soon is the White Light Festival at Lincoln Center.
This is an annual festival at Lincoln Center, as you mentioned. It is a multidisciplinary event. There's theater and dance and music. And a lot of it is actually very focused on music and sort of the spiritual nature of music in particular. Like you mentioned, it's going to end in mid-November. But there are a couple of different shows that people can still catch that are coming up. I would highlight maybe one or two.
Please.
One is a production of Waiting for Godot, which
Godot
from the Druid Theatre Company that coming over from Ireland. And then there is the U.S. premiere of a new opera by Kaha Sarriaho, and it is directed by Peter Sellers. And this is, it's basically Ezra Pound's translations of two Japanese no plays. But Kara Sarriaho is a really big composer, someone to pay attention to, and that is coming later in November, something to check out.
Ezra Pound.
Ezra Pound in opera. So in addition, there's still a few dance performances that are available as well to see. There's one from England called Black, White, Gray, which is a dance troupe that is from East London that really kind of explores issues of politics through hip hop, and is just another attempt to kind of explore our inner lives through dance, through music, and just a festival that's always been very successful.
That's so exciting, the White Light Festival at Lincoln Center. Charlie, you always come through with us, for us, every week.
Trying to find the best I can.
I thought you might come in with white lights. around you this week because of the lay last
week. No, last week had the lay for the botanical show with the George O'Keefe. I know, trying to find props. It's a little hard on radio.
Next week.
Next week.
Charlie Herman, thank you so much.
You bet.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC. We do want to let you know that coming up this hour, we're expecting a press conference from the Department of Justice about the package bomb investigation. WNYC will carry special coverage of that press conference when it happens live. Stay tuned for that. That's scheduled sometime in the 2 o'clock hour. That is our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Capriglione, and Ursula Summer. Matt Miranda is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is All of It, WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Be good and be safe.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.